People make millions of dollars every year playing pretend. They are idolized by billions of people around the world. They are respected, imitated, and even treated on as experts on a wide range of subjects that they know nothing about, all because of their skill at playing pretend. And we call them actors and actresses. They may not appreciate my characterization of that as playing pretend, but the reality is we know that when we watch a TV show or a movie that the people on the screen are not actually who they appear to be. We know the blood is not real blood. We know the breakup is not a real heartbreak. We know the romance is not true love. We know the villain is probably not actually that evil of a person. They are playing a role. They're wearing masks and costumes. They recite lines written by somebody else and playing a role that has been assigned to them by someone else. So that no matter how skilled they may be at their acting, we know that when they go home, they take off the makeup and they go home to who they really are. So we know that Gene Kelly did not actually break into a perfectly choreographed dance routine on sidewalks on rainy evenings. We know that William Shatner did not actually captain a spaceship, and John Wayne did not ever actually gun anybody down in the dusty streets. They're just acting. And yet the fact that we know those three names and probably dozens more reveals just how important a place acting has in our culture. That may be fine for entertainment, but acting has no place in our religious practice. And I would imagine that if we all have a definition of a hypocrite, we have some working knowledge of what we would call that, how we would describe that. So most people would probably understand a hypocrite to be someone who says one thing but does another, or maybe someone who condemns a person while secretly doing the same thing or even worse. And Jesus used the word hypocrite. He used it in several different occasions. But when he uses that word hypocrite, he's using a word that in the first century was recognized and understood to be a pretender. Somebody who puts on a mask and performs for an audience. And so with that in mind, let's read these first six verses of Matthew 6. Jesus says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and that your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." So Jesus is addressing specifically the practices of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees believed that all the world was a stage and they wanted to be the main attraction, so that all of their religious actions were a performance put on for the applause of their neighbors. And Jesus strongly rebuked this attitude which saw religious duty as performance art. And in all of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is confronting and correcting the errors of the Pharisees. But in this section, he begins to teach directly against the practices, the way the Pharisees acted. So we can go back, as we've looked in previous weeks in the Sermon on the Mount, to verses 31 and 33 and 38 and 43. Jesus is declaring the teachings of the Pharisees to be in order. Now in chapter 6, he shows the Pharisees to be hypocrites, whose outward righteousness was fake. It was a disguise which covered a selfish heart. So in most of Matthew 5, Jesus was teaching that the righteousness of the Pharisees could not earn eternal life. Now in Matthew chapter 6, in this first half, Jesus is teaching that the righteousness of the Pharisees could not earn eternal reward. In Matthew 6, verse 1 is really a summary of the main point that Jesus is making in these first 17 verses of the 6th chapter. Now in Matthew 6, 9 through 15, we have the Lord's Prayer and Jesus teaching about forgiveness. But really, those are parentheses. They're actually not the main point of what Jesus is making. The main point of the first 18 verses here is that the Pharisees' righteousness gained them no rewards in heaven, because their motives were wrong. And so Jesus condemns good works, prayer, and fasting done for the attention and praise of men. Jesus commands good work, prayer, and fasting that is done for the praise of God alone. And so he starts off by addressing our merciful deeds, what the New King James calls charitable deeds. We think of charity, and we probably still have a pretty good idea of what charity is. When we talk about it, we mean helping those who are in need. And I would remind you that Jesus is assuming we're going to be doing these things. We have a clear biblical obligation to do good to others, so that the New Testament insists the Christian is to be active in doing good, in ministering to the needs of others, so that we as Christians must be a charitable people. Our acts of mercy must begin in the church, but they must move outward to our community. So that, as 1 Timothy 6 says, we must do good, be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. And this kind of charity was common in Jerusalem in Jesus' day. Regular collections were taken at the temple for distribution to the poor. But as happens still today, people misused that for their own self-promotion. And so Jesus corrects the abuse of that practice with what may seem like to us kind of a ridiculous warning, because he says, "Do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets." We're not supposed to hire somebody to go play a trumpet before we give. And we may wonder if anybody actually did that. And it seems like that actually was a practice, that there was were those Pharisees that would hire somebody to blow a trumpet when they were giving. And we may chuckle at very obvious self-centered displays of giving, but any giving done for the praise of men is just as silly and just as wrong. Now, I don't think, maybe they would, but I don't know of anybody that would hire a brass band to announce their giving. But we have certainly found a whole host of other ways to toot our own horns. If you doubt that, just scroll through social media. Maybe I shouldn't recommend scrolling through social media, but it provides limitless opportunities for praise seekers to draw attention to themselves. I found a number of examples online this week. Let me give you one that was particularly bad. Whoever this was says, "I saw a homeless man in front of Walmart, and I was only getting one thing because I didn't have much money. But instead, I bought a case of water and gave it to the man. I gave him the last of my money and walked away crying, because I just felt God praising me for putting others before myself." And we, I trust, would recognize that that is not selfless at all, but is a backhanded selfishness. Most people probably are not that crass, but we still find a lot of ways to attract attention. People promise to give to an organization if somebody will, if some part of the building will be named after them. Or they will give a large check if the photographer is there to take the picture of them and put it in the paper that they have done this. I do know that sometimes the organization hires the photographer and not the person giving, but not always. And sometimes somebody will just take a picture of themselves beside the house they helped build. They'll post it online with a caption like, "So blessed." And it's very subtle. Self-promotion. And we are all tempted by the desire for the praise of people. And there are times where we do good works without even realizing that we are craving the attention and the applause from others. And so what's the solution to that? How do we do good works without falling into the temptation of being self-seeking and self-promoting in it? Jesus says in verse 3, "When you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing." We guard against this tendency to self-seeking service with secrecy. We, instead of going to great lengths to make sure people know we are giving, we go to great lengths to make sure nobody knows that we are giving. Well, so what Jesus says is we should not even let our left hand know what our right hand is doing. Now, I think it's very obvious that it should be understood as hyperbole. It's not literal, but Jesus is, if you will, exaggerating for effect. So I don't think he actually says, put your left hand in your pocket while you're writing the check. But rather that we should do whatever we need to. He's kind of making this over-the-top statement to show us just how important it is that we avoid all attention-seeking in our giving. And this is for our own benefit. Because this desire for notice and praise of others is incredibly strong. And we very often and very easily fall before its temptation. And when somebody does notice our giving and they applaud it, we are quick to imagine that, yeah, we're deserving of praise. That, yeah, it was generous of me. Oh, I know we wouldn't think it quite that clearly, but there's a certain self-satisfaction that comes with that. So to guard ourselves from the temptation, we go out of our way to keep others from noticing. For the sake of our own humility, we ought to do all that we can to hide our giving. Now, I will say this doesn't mean that somebody knows that you've given, that you've sinned. And certainly, there's, I think in just about every situation, somebody's going to know you gave. But I remind you, Jesus praised the woman who publicly anointed his feet with a very costly ointment. He did not rebuke her because she did it publicly and it wasn't secret giving. He praised her. And so I don't think it at all is intended to exclude every person ever knowing that you have given. And so I would also say with that, if you're married, you and your spouse need to know what each other's giving. You should be discussing and planning your giving together. The two of you are one flesh. It certainly does not violate this principle for the two of you to discuss together your giving. I don't think this instruction necessarily condemns keeping of records for either a church's sake or a nonprofit's sake or for tax purposes, for your own tax exemptions tax deductions there. But at the same time, if you want to give cash, drop your money in the offering box when nobody else is around or donate anonymously, then you have very solid biblical grounds for doing so. And I think our bent should be to give silently, that none else know about it. And it is this secrecy of giving which will ultimately reveal your true motives. It will help you understand what's actually going on in your own heart when you give. Because if you're giving for the notice of others, even when you don't notice it yourself, when you're giving that others may see it, you're not going to be able to keep it secret. You're going to have to tell somebody. You will have to drop a hint or let it slip or post a picture or something. When nobody notices, you will be annoyed if you're giving for the other's attention. If you cannot be content when your giving goes entirely unnoticed, then selfishness has crept into your motives, and you are giving to receive praise of men. However, if you're truly giving for the praise and reward of God, then you will have no problem if no one ever notices. In fact, you can be content to give in secret because you know two things about God. Look at verse 4. It says, "Your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly." And so your left hand may not know what your right hand is doing, but God knows every detail of your service. He sees in secret and knows every part of your life so that he knows all your deeds, all your gifts, all your motivations. So that if I'm giving truly for the pleasure and praise of God, I know that no matter if nobody else sees it or knows anything about it, he did. So my audience saw it. There's no doubt about that. And that should encourage us in our giving. It should also challenge us to give properly. It should encourage us because no merciful deed we do will slip past God's notice. Therefore, we can give secretly in confidence that God sees. It also should challenge us because no secret motivation will escape God's attention. Therefore, we give carefully with the conviction that your motives are known by God. And you can also give in secret because you know God will not fail to reward that which is done for him. Not only will he see, but he will respond properly. He will not overlook a single gift that is given in his name for his glory. The book of Galatians encourages us to continue to give and to do good because of the certainty of God's reward. He says, "Let us not grow weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." Now, some have argued that Christians should not appeal to rewards as a motivation for service, and that any desire for reward from God makes that work less pure or less spiritual. And so some would say that we should do things because we love God, with no regard to any reward we might get out of it. There's almost a disinterest in it, if you will. Do you think a football player's love for the game is less because he trains with the goal of winning the Super Bowl and not just out of a sheer love for the game? Is not the championship a fitting reward for someone who truly loves the game? Is not the desire to win the championship a proper desire for one who truly loves the sport? And much more so, seeking the crowns of victory that God has promised his faithful servants is a proper desire for the one who truly loves God. And really, the protest that rewards are not a good reason to do good deeds has one really glaring problem. You might have already noticed it. Such a view is more scrupulous than God himself. Jesus appeals directly to future rewards as a motivation for present obedience. That's what he says in verse 4. And he says it again in verse 6. He says it later when he's talking about fasting. He appeals to our rewards. He does it later in Matthew 25 in the parable of the talents. In Mark 9 when he promises reward for a cup of cold water given in his name. He does it again in Revelation 2 and 3 when he promises Christians will receive rich rewards for faithful obedience to him. The New Testament repeatedly offers heavenly rewards as encouragement to believers to serve faithfully. So God is not shy about offering us rewards as a motivation to obedience. The Bible does not suggest that being motivated by reward is mercenary or unspiritual. The Bible does not teach that being motivated by reward is contrary to a deep love for God. But rather, if we truly love God, we will do good for His glory and to receive from Him the rewards He has promised. And so we can do good in secret, knowing that God will see and that God will reward, and says He will reward openly. And then in Matthew 6, verse 5, Jesus begins to speak about prayer. Just as we should not give for the praise of others, so we should not pray to receive praise of others. Now, the Jews in Jesus' day had three set times of prayer. Once in the morning, once in the middle of the day, and once in the evening. And when those set times for prayer came, the Pharisees would position themselves on the corners of the busiest streets and pray there. It says, you see there in verse 5, it says they loved to pray in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets. That word street, it's not just a general word for any street. Any little lane. It is a specific word for a broad street, a wide road. So the Pharisees would pray on the corner of the four-lane thoroughfare in the middle of the city. They would find that busiest intersection in the entire city so that the maximum number of people could see them in prayer. Jesus says they also loved to pray standing in the synagogue. And so to modernize it some, the Pharisees loved to be the ones called on to pray during the church service. Their prayer was a performance that was put on for the praise of men. And I trust we all recognize such praying is not really prayer. So when you pray, do not go downtown at old concrete median at the Y intersection in Manistique. It's probably our busiest intersection. Don't stop there and stand there and pray. Don't go in Triangle Park in front of the post office and pray there. Do not post on Facebook how blessed you are that you had a marvelous 3-hour time of prayer this morning. Pray in secret. Do not long to be asked to pray in church. Do not hunger for the attention or the chance to let everybody know what you may be thinking. Do not get annoyed if you're not asked to pray in public. But instead, what Jesus says is pray in secret. Verse 6, when you pray, go into your room. And when you have shut your door, pray to your Father. Pray in secret. The King James uses the word closet. And the exact meaning of that word is a little bit uncertain, but it was likely a small storage room. It would have been out of the way in the house as a place where people did not frequent and you could reasonably expect privacy. So Jesus is teaching that you should not find a public place to pray, but a hiding place. You should pray secretly. And if you are praying secretly, you will not be tempted to pray for the praise of men. And let me add this. If you do not pray privately, you have no business praying publicly. If your only prayers are public prayers, then you have a prayer problem. You must get alone with God. You must deal with Him one-on-one. Learn to commune with God. Learn to pray in secret. Have that close relationship with Him and Him alone. And if the only time you're ever praying is in public, you're praying as the hypocrites prayed. But if you've learned that close fellowship with God, it won't matter if you never get asked to pray in public or if nobody ever notices that you pray. If you have that close relationship with God, it won't matter if you do get called on to pray in public. You will not be praying for the attention of others because you've already cultivated this relationship and you know and you cherish that most. And I would say as well, there's a severe warning here, a sobering warning. There's the presence of sin when we pray. Should be a warning to us of the continued influence of sin in our lives. I mean, really, I don't think there's anything that we would say is more spiritual, more holy, if you will, than praying. And yet here we find warning of the presence of sin when we are doing the very thing that should be farthest removed from it. I mean, honestly, how messed up is it that we can go to the God of heaven and we can say that we are speaking with our Creator and Savior from entirely selfish motives? So that we can pray with the deceitfulness of sin in our hearts for the praise of men rather than fellowship with God. How blinding is sin that we at times pray when completely oblivious to the fact that we are not communing with God in any way, or concerned with what He is concerned with. And I think if we're honest in all of our prayer life, we find that, I mean, at the very least, you've been praying for 5 minutes and you have realized that I'm suddenly distracted by a fly. The heater came on and now there's a little bit of dust blowing in the air. I'm thinking somebody needs to dust the house. I have just gone into the throne room of God, speaking to the Creator and Lord of the universe, and I'm distracted by a fly. I condemn myself with that. So by all means, I know my own heart and tendency to drift away. It's the presence of sin should challenge us to always be on guard. Not to drive us away from prayer, not to say, oh, I just can't pray. I always goof it up, I can't do it. No, drive us deeper into prayer. Drive us farther away from sin, that we are always wary of the presence of sin, especially when we are doing religious works. And so we work and fight to oppose that self-seeking tendency of our sinful hearts by praying in secret. Again, going and finding a private, secluded place so that no one will know you are praying. And again, just as I said with giving, this exhortation for secret prayer cannot be read as forbidding all public praying. We cannot even read it as forbidding all public prayer for the hearing and benefit of those present. And so we can't say, well, yeah, you can pray in public, but you can't think about the people that are around you. And I say that we can pray publicly and we can pray for the good of our hearers because of the model of Jesus Himself. In John chapter 11, Jesus prayed publicly. And He said in His public prayer that He was praying for the benefit of those who were hearing Him. He said, Father, I thank You that You've heard me, and I know that You always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. So Jesus was praying, but not for the praise of those hearing him, but for the glory of God. But when Jesus prayed, he prayed with an eye on his audience. He did not pray with an eye on himself. John 17, Jesus prayed at length for the disciples. And he did so in their hearing, for their encouragement. And so public prayers are not sinful. They are modeled for us by Jesus himself. We see it also modeled by the apostles, by prophets, which throughout scriptures. However, we go back to Jesus and we see that the public prayers were the minority of his prayers. The prayer life of Jesus was not primarily public. We are told frequently that Jesus went apart to pray. He separated himself even from the disciples to pray and to pray in secret. And it happened far more often than his public prayers. And so likewise, our secret private prayers must be more numerous than our public prayers. And we pray like this, again, verse 6, because our Father sees in secret, but he also says, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place. So we find a secret place to pray to the God who dwells in the secret place. He who dwells in secret and sees in secret will not fail to hear your secret prayers, nor will he fail to give open reward to those whose service was previously hidden. And so pray. Pray in private for the praise of God and God alone. Our motives for doing religious works matter. If you are not doing good and praying for the pleasure of God and God alone, then you're playing pretend. You're putting on a show to impress whatever audience that you hope you have. If you give, or if you pray for the praise of men, you'll have the reward you seek. Jesus says that both in verse 2 and in verse 5. They have the reward. If you seek the praise of men, you'll have what you seek. But you will not have the reward of God. When you pray, when you give, pray and give to be seen of him. Do not give up that greater reward, his eternal joy, his eternal reward, to gain a lesser reward. You might have momentary gratification, but you will lose. You will not have that which is of eternal benefit. And so serve, pray for the praise of God.